Welcome to the Business Podcast, where we interview professionals across all industries.
Hey, it's Simon. Welcome back. Today we have Josiah Ung, a three-time Olympic cyclist and former world number one holder in Keirin. Now a family man with two daughters, a performance coach, motivational speaker, and lover of life. Josiah, it's great to have you here with us today. How are you?
Yeah, thanks for having me, Ayman. I'm doing fantastic. It's the end of the day here in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, and I get to end my day with this exciting conversation. Thanks for having me.
Wonderful. Well, maybe you can kick us off. Tell us a little bit about yourself outside of what I already described, and maybe share something that most people do not know about you.
Okay. I think first things that come, I went to my 20-year high school reunion. I think it was before COVID. And the first thing people, when they saw me there, say, well, you're the most unlikely Olympian. So I thought that was pretty interesting, the most unlikely Olympian, because I remember back in middle school, I mean, I grew up in California, so I'm American educated, even though I represented Malaysia. As you can tell from my my slang, I was not talented as an athlete. I was always picked last or close to last in PE class. I took the pathway that was not really meant for me. So I'm from a very traditional Chinese, Malaysian, or Asian background, upbringing. You know, my whole family are string musicians, trained classical musicians, as well as they're all in healthcare, right? So doctors, nurses, dentists, and whatnot. So my pathway was not made for me to be to turn out how it did. And I battled through a lot of challenges throughout my journey, including being given the ultimatum of moving out of my house or being homeless at 18 on my 18th birthday if I didn't quit my silly dream of being an Olympian.
Well, that alone is incredible to hear. Maybe you can talk a little bit about how you got your start in being an athlete and then walk us through the journey from there to what you're doing now.
Okay. I always loved bicycles because that it meant freedom to me from my strict Asian parents, you know, always pressuring me to do homework and study and practice my violin. So the bicycle meant freedom for a short period of time each day. And my neighbor turned out to be 1984. I don't think he made the Olympic team, but he was like national champion in the U.S. And I begged him to buy his wife's bike. And I talked my grandmother into helping me bake 250 cookies to sell door to door for $1 a piece. To raise $250 back in 1994, that's a lot of money to buy that bicycle. So, I entered my first race at 14 and I got absolute last place out of about 40 kids, girls and guys included. So I was dead last. And I really thought I was devastated, but I really was determined. And I did goal setting and I said, you know, I had to get top five. That was my goal short term. I did some research, read some books on how to train, found a coach. And, at that time, you know, every kid, you know, all my rivals had full support of their parents and I didn't. So I had to be resourceful in order to make my goals and my dreams come true, which included making sure that all the my rivals' parents knew my story and, building my contact list, my black book, and figuring out a way to hitch rides to races every weekend. So It was something that I don't see too often these days, because it's, I said, it seems like every the youth these days, everything's handed, a lot of things are handed to them. But I had to go out and get, I had to go and make everything happen on my own in order to be successful, including I didn't have my national team. You know, I had a Malaysian passport. Actually, I tried to get on U.S. team. I actually got into the U.S. Olympic trials in 2000, in the year 2000, illegally, if illegally, because I wasn't U.S. citizen yet. But I snuck in, and I beat the Olympic champion from United States, Marty Nostein. But I wrote a letter to the U.S. Olympic Committee, and they didn't reply. So my alternative was to figure out if I could use the pathway of my passport, Malaysia. They didn't have really much of a program, so I had to build the program from scratch. And, you know, over the last 20 plus years, I've built this program quite well. And my former teammate got won a silver medal at this last Olympics in Tokyo, and he won a bronze in the previous Olympics in Rio. So, you know, now we have a world-class program, multi-million dollar program in Malaysia. And I'm very proud to be one of the forefathers of that.
So Josiah, that's really incredible what you just described around having that grit and going for what you wanted at a young age. You started competing and you couldn't afford to get the bike, so you worked with your family so that you can bake cookies and sell them. So it seems like you had a very early start on just going after what you wanted, and I think that has a lot to do with a certain mindset that you have. So maybe you can talk a bit more about the mindset that you've crafted and you've developed in order to win championships, in order to build programs for you to even compete.
So this mindset is been a real asset for my family, for my livelihood. You know, about the time right before COVID came, you know, I started to build this, and with the help from the IOC and Airbnb, they were helping Olympians to make extra revenue, extra income. And so I just thought, okay, I'll go for it. And I titled it, Olympian mind, what do you call, cultivating an Olympian mindset for everyday life. Because, you know, Olympian mindset's great and all, but if it's not relevant to the audience, and the audience is mostly non-sports people, right? So a lot of corporates or whatnot, a lot of tech companies, banking, insurance companies, that want that edge, that Olympian mindset to help them achieve their targets, their goals, their to help their team to the next level. So I racked up my brain and you know, did some brainstorming, put matrix together, and identified key character traits that I built that could be that could help everyday people achieve their everyday goals. You know, of course, one of I can't share all of it, of course, but some of it's you know, a lot of it's based on mentorship, cultivating mentorship, as well as goal setting. So those two things are key. And applicable for almost everything in life, right? In your private life, in your career, of course, in sports, and it's adaptable to all those. So, yeah. So that's what I've been doing over the course of the pandemic, and it's grown from. At first I was doing, you know, one-on-ones or small groups. And I think initially I charged $20 per person, and now I'm, you know, getting a hefty sum to speak for companies like Google, Intel, AWS, Microsoft, and the works. So it's been an incredible journey, and I've had a lot of, you know, growth as well for myself, as a speaker, as a leader, as a coach. And it's been fun, and I know I'm just scratching the surface too, so it's great.
That's very inspiring to hear yet again. And Josiah, you mentioned how you had a Malaysian passport and you now reside there, and aside from the rich culture that it has and the incredible food and fusions of flavors that are there, what are some notable things about your experience having gone to Malaysia and set up your life right now as it is, in comparison to when you grew up in California? Maybe you can talk about that.
Yeah. Okay. The first thing is the culture. I would say that, like, American culture, the winning mindset, the need to win, is one of the pillars of American culture. You know, the great American dream. Everyone, can't say everyone, but it's widely practiced that you can be what you want to be. You can be a minority, but you can be the president of the United States if you put your mind to it. Right? You can be an NFL player. You can be an Olympian. You can do anything. Americans tell their kids, their youth, you can do it. Right? In Malaysia, it's a little bit different. Actually, it's a lot different. Over here, it's more of, don't stick out. You know, do something that's safe. Make sure your family is taken care of, you know, focus on sustainability, you know, don't dream too big. Right. So over here, I've coined this phrase that when I coach, 16, development athletes within cycling and MotoGP development athletes, like Moto3, Moto2 riders. And the first thing that I bring to the table is, I've been thinking about putting it on a shirt. It's called Nak Menang, NakMenang. Nak Menang is literally translated as the need to win. I said, we have to approach every day, everything we do, with the need to win. Because over here, when people, we're used in US, you're used to like, go get them and go kick butt, or, you know, bring it on, or, you know, go do it, go win. Over here, they say, try your best. Or when you didn't win, you didn't do well, they say, oh, never mind, you tried your best. So that's the difference. I said, try your best. That really bothered me. Try your best is like an excuse already for failure. So I try to reprogram the people that I work with, the young athletes or the corporate, those in corporate, right? The C-suites. We need to adopt this Nak Menang in our culture, the need to win. We have to win. We need to win every single day, everything we do, every step of the way. And that's how you're going to achieve your goals. Nak Menang.
I had to write that down. And I think the big one is the need to win is really a need because you're capable. And there should be this duty to reach your potential. Maybe you could talk about how you expanded your personal achievements and your view of self along the way. You must have had mentors. In addition to developing this mindset of yours, how you were able to overcome challenges in competing, in training.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one of the modules that I make, that I go through with everyone I'm working with is the mentorship module. First we go through why do we need mentorship? What is a mentorship? How do we get a mentorship? And how do we, what are the best strategies to grow that mentorship and menteeship, right? So that both sides get something out of it, right? So yeah, we go through that. First of all, I give them my background. I had 9 mentors throughout my career, and each one had its place at its time. So if I had like this, my early coach or mentor that late in my career, it wouldn't have been as effective and whatnot, right? So each mentor have their place, and how did I approach the mentor, and do I still keep in touch with them? Do I still work with them? What kind of mentor? So general life mentors, sport specific mentor. You know, even my sports psychologist, I still keep in touch with him as a mentor. I still use him. I used to use as a sounding board for a lot of my ideas. So yeah, I go through pretty deep into that, and then we of course we make a bit of a roadmap for them just to get them started on their mentorship growth journey.
That's great. As you were speaking, you're working with people who want to be very high performers, who want to compete on the world stage and to win. And yes, with that comes a pressure in addition to a strong duty to achieve that. Because, you know, when you say you want to compete at the Olympics, you're telling the people around you that you want to win, that you're going to win, that you're... Yeah. You're going to make all your achievements count for the gold, if you will. And I'm curious what opinions you have when it comes to mental health, because a lot of athletes, or in general, it's recommended that to have good mental health, you want to be active. So for sure, athletes are active. So what are some things that you've observed or you might have done to maintain that mental health, or what kind of opinions do you have about that topic in general?
Mental health has, in my opinion, has to always be worked on. It's just no different than training your body. You stop doing that for 1 or 2 years and you'll be out of shape, right? So same thing with mental health. We have to always work on our mental health. We have to incorporate habits that are good, that feed the positive side of our mental health. For example, today is my 42nd birthday, and I took my wife to a hammam spa treatment for 3 hours. So within the spa treatment, of course, you have the scrub. They scrub your skin. It's a Moroccan spa. You know, you're in this kind of sauna type room. And then after that, you get a massage. And then after that, you go in the hot tub. So you cultivate your relationships because I booked it for my wife and myself. So it's physical and mental. Right. So it's part of my meditation for today. I had practiced my deep breathing when I was getting my skin scrubbed, not just because it hurt too, right? Because it's the deep scrub. So, you know, this is a perfect example something that I utilize to help me reset. I mean, I got 2 young kids. It can be very stressful to, you know, sleepless nights sometimes, Last night was a bad night for us when the kids were up. Then I had to wake up at 5:20 to go coach. Yeah, and then so I had to reset. So mental health, right? Yeah, it's something that, you know, I'm still working on. It's something that we have to manage, right? Engine management, really. And meditation is key, right? Because that's the engine management part of our lives, and life management, to give our mind a break each day so that we can reset. And not, you know, meditation, we, you know, everyone thinks of maybe a Buddhism type, but there's many forms, and different ones, different types work differently for different people. For me, what works well is deep breathing exercises and deep tissue massage. Well, maybe one of the reasons I fell in love with my wife, who's a trained sports therapist, a deep tissue therapist. So, but it works.
Management. Well, that's great to hear. That's great to hear. And what you said is a really unique word, engine management, for your body, your mind, and your muscles. And that connection there.
Yes. And it's really highly underrated. So most sports professionals, they focus a lot on recovery, on supplementation and whatnot. But until recently, not many broached the subject or delve deep into mental recovery. And I think that's something the general public also ignores for the most part until recently. I mean, you know, you hear about it more and more, mental health, you know, hashtags, but do people really delve into it? Do they identify, do they study different types of strategies, of things that they can adopt in their daily lives to help them manage? I don't think that's very common now yet.
Absolutely. And thanks for making those observations. We talked about it a bit around how you had helped to build the program that you now coach at. But maybe you could talk a little bit more about your thought process in deciding to pivot your career into doing that. And what were the motivations there?
Yes. Okay. So, well, I think first things first, life pivot from being a professional athlete in something so specific and so intense, and to have to pivot in life and to start all over. One of the most challenging things about being an athlete, it's more challenging than getting to the Olympics, than getting to the top. Once you get to the top and then your body no longer can serve that purpose as effectively, meaning that you need to call it a day. That period, you often hear of athletes going into depression, going bankrupt, having the, you know, being in a rut. That was also me. You know, I tried to prepare myself as much as possible. I did a lot of job shadowing. So I took it apart. You know, I really was quite proactive in the last year of my career. Okay, what's next? I need to get a head jump, a head start, blah, blah, blah. You know, I did network marketing because I knew the skill sets that help you to be a sharper salesperson. And, you know, in almost everything we do in life, can benefit from having sharper sales skills, right? I did a tech startup in hospitality. So I have zero technical knowledge. or almost zero technical knowledge other than how to knowing how to check my email, and I had zero hospitality experience, but I had Olympian mindset, the belief that all I and I knew how to build a team. So I I partnered with a former venture capital guy, and we built this private dining platform where it's like Uber chefs, where you can book a private chef to cook in your home for you and your family in the comfort and convenience of your home. And the chef does all the work. They, you pick off their menus, book their time. They shop, prep, cook, serve, and clean in the comfort of your home, and you can enjoy culinary delights. And I raised $500,000 AUD, which, back then I was living in Melbourne, Australia, and I onboarded 50 chefs, some of them Michelin star. So I did it. I became a tech entrepreneur. And, I had dreams of going to Silicon Valley, raising more venture capital, Series A, Series B, going IPO, blah, blah, blah. And then, the proverbial shit hit the fan and my life fell apart. My marriage failed, actually crashed. And it just didn't work out. So I had to figure out again, a year and a half later, start from scratch again. So it was quite the journey. So pivoting is tough. I had to, my divorce was really messy, involved a lot of lawyers, which was, I had sleepless nights. I decided one thing that really helped me, and that my sports psychologist, one of my mentors, he recommended that I take a little bit of time out. So I took a year and a half sabbatical, moved to Chiang Mai, Thailand, where all the hippies like to go, and reset. And there I found coaching. The Thai national team figured out through social media I was there, and they offered me an 8-month contract to help their prepare their athlete for the Asian Games. And my former teammate would be my rival, right? My athlete's rival. He was the current world champion at that time. And in 8 months, I helped their athlete do the almost impossible and beat the world champion, my former teammate, at the Asian Games on Merdeka, which is Malaysia's Independence Day. So, of course, back home in Malaysia, I was considered a traitor. I helped the neighbor, the enemy, to beat our beloved champion. So I had a lot of flack, and the pressure was to move back home and serve my own country, which I did after my contract was done. But then politics came into play, racial politics here. There's a lot of that here in Malaysia. And I didn't actually get the national team job. So I had to start from scratch. Okay, what next? And luckily, one of the things that came up, along with COVID, was this opportunity on Airbnb. And the IOC is an initiative to help Olympians to make extra revenue in whatever skill set they have. For example, if you're Olympian, that you can play guitar or drums, you can put that experience on Airbnb and someone can hang out with you and play drums with an Olympian. So for me, it's I developed the how to cultivate a mindset of an Olympian mindset, but have it apply to your everyday life. And little over a year and a half later, I'm helping some of the leading companies in the world, their teams achieve their goals and to acquire an Olympian winning mindset.
So Josiah, when you were talking about this platform that you created, that sounds like a great technology. What was it called?
It's called Entertain with an I, like entertain in your home with our chefs.
Right. Oh, that's a really cool name.
Yeah, well, I wonder. Yeah, it was a fun process going through that branding exercise, the branding process. I learned a lot doing this tech startup. I learned about so many skill sets that I picked up that I use in my everyday life now. You know, I was the CEO, the chief eating officer. yeah, and that's a bit of a branding thing too, right? So a lot of things are brand positioning, right? It's basically to catch people's attention with what you're doing. I learned a lot about stakeholder management, learned the process of capital raising, managing a team, pitching, writing 1-2 pagers all the time to proposals. I think sportsmen and sportswomen, that skill sets needed to survive and to thrive these days, especially early in the sporting journey, is writing written skills. So, you know, I would recommend that every aspiring professional athlete really nails down English class and public speaking class. Those skill sets come in real handy when you polish them up, because that's the way that you can make a living and you can get sponsors. You know, early on in my career, when before I turned professional, before years before I even went to the Olympics, I needed sponsorship because I didn't have the resources. I didn't have parents to help me. I was already, on my 18th birthday, I was on my own, homeless, so to speak. I was couch surfing. So when I needed something like sunglasses, for example, and even though I was an established sportsman, I wrote letters to different companies, that local glasses manufacturers. And my first sponsor when I was 17, was called GOAT, G-O-A-T, sunglasses out of Southern California. And I remember the day I got, they wanted to sponsor me. They really liked my proposal, my 2-page proposal, what I would do for them in return if they were to sponsor me. And I got 20 pairs of sunglasses as part of that sponsorship that year. And I thought that was the coolest thing as a 17-year-old. And all of my rivals thought, wow, how did you do that? You haven't even won the state championships. Of course, that year I did end up winning the state championships after I got sponsored. So, you know, these skill sets that I think is... You know, these days I find, you know, I run a cycling gloves specific glove brand called Five Bling. Five meaning the number five is my last name. NG means number five in Cantonese, and bling. I love a little bit of bling, of course. And I grew my brand to being the number one brand in my sport of track cycling, with nearly zero marketing budget. But I got a lot of people just sending me a message over Instagram, can you sponsor me? I'm good. And I thought to myself, man, I could only do a little bit of a workshop for these guys and gals on how to position yourself and to write a proposal to get a sponsorship. It's not that difficult. And even now that I am retired, I'm still getting free products. I'm getting offers, getting paid to do some promotions, just because I have those core skill sets.
Yeah, maybe you can talk a little bit about Five Bling, because what you just said about it being the number one brand in your sport is incredible. But what's equally incredible is that you went from founding a software company to a
product company, a physical product. Could you talk a little bit about that journey, how you got the idea, how you went through the development, and ultimately began having your first sales?
Yeah, this was, I think, my second Olympic Games. I really found that a lot of cyclists, track cyclists, were wearing baseball gloves. And I just thought it wasn't cool. And I'm like, surely there's a brand out there that makes that can make specific gloves for what we need. We need aerodynamics. So we need aerodynamic slippery material. And then we need gloves that basically are a second skin, not too thick. We need it sticky. We need our fingers that are sticky, so we grip our handlebars, you know, when we're sweating or whatnot, and still be grippy. So I went out to, you know, sample all different kinds of gloves. And then I went to China to pitch my ideas to factories to help me manufacture gloves. Then I figured out, okay, so how I need a strong brand that represented me. And you know, I eventually landed on Five Bling. I thought it was catchy. Then I developed the logo, and then I had to get the awareness out there. So I was going to World Cups and World Championships, and all of these guys were wearing golf gloves or baseball gloves, and I started handing out my gloves. And at the next Olympic Games, 2012, 90% of the Olympic medals for every event were wearing my gloves. And so shortly after, I stopped having the sponsor, and you know, it's all incoming by now. So running that company, it's, you know, it's very niche, but I don't have to put too much resources into it. And it kind of runs itself. I have a couple of distributors throughout the world, and, you know, and it's a nice side income, right? Because, you know, as an entrepreneur, a lot of them tell you when you're an athlete, if you have multiple sources of income, that's great. That's a good thing, right? Then you don't have to worry about where your next meal comes from, especially for American athletes, right? Because funding is so scarce for Olympic sports, and the government, you know, doesn't really support American athletes, right? So you find that a lot of American athletes have to dip into their savings or rely on family and whatnot. So if you have a couple side income gigs, you know, the whole life is a lot easier.
Well, Josiah, it's been a pleasure speaking with you so far, and learning about the experiences you've had and how you've been not only achieving a lot personally, but helping others do the same at the highest level of competition. If we were to switch gears a bit, and you had the opportunity to go back in time to any point in history and meet with anyone, who comes to mind?
Wow, that's something I've never thought of before. But I would say, since Olympics is such a huge part of my life, I'd love to have lunch with Pierre de Coubertin, so the father of the modern Olympic Games. I think that would be interesting, or very, very intriguing. So that's who I would choose.
Well, that's phenomenal. And of course, until we speak again, perhaps you could share a parting thought.
Yeah. So I think I'll send everyone off with two small things, reminders, when they go out to achieve their goals, or when they go out to do anything that they in their daily lives is. I remind my teams to huddle, and first one is the beast mode on. So to turn your beast mode on, right? And then the second one's the need to win, not mana. Go out there with the need to win, and that will go a long way to help you achieving your goals.
Thank you so much, Josiah.
Thanks, Simon.
Thanks for attending the Business Podcast, and stay tuned for more episodes.